Welcome to the HR Uprising podcast. This highly practical podcast series explores HR and management hot topics and challenges through conversations with relevant experts and real-life people professionals. Brought to you by Actus Software, our aim is to build a better workplace for people. The HR Uprising is about collaborating and supporting each other to build the confidence and skills to rise up to each challenge and deliver real, lasting business value. You can find out more at hruprising.com or join our LinkedIn community. Now introducing your host, chartered psychologist, best-selling author, entrepreneur and speaker, Lucinda Carney.
Hello and welcome to this week's HR Uprising podcast. And this week, I'm really delighted that Vicky Roberts is joining me. Now, Vicky Roberts was a name that I came across on the good old HR Ninjas, where I pick up a lot of our podcast guests. And she came as a very highly recommended employment law solicitor. So Vicky works within Vista Employee Services, and she also heads up the learning services team there. And I'm going to get you, Vicky, in a minute to explain a little bit more about what Vista Employment Services is. But the purpose really for me of this podcast was, we know that employment law is one of those topics that certainly I would not feel able to try and provide accurate information myself. So we really do need to draw on the experience of experts. But there's so much, I suppose, challenge and complexity around at the moment in the way in which our working environment is changing. So when Vicky and I were talking about what we would talk about within this podcast, there were loads of topics we could go into, but we decided that the whole challenge of managing a hybrid workforce and the employment law potential complexities that come with that would be a really good relevant topic for this audience right now. So Vicky, thank you so much for joining us. Would you like to tell me a bit about yourself and also maybe explain a bit about Vista?
Yeah, of course. Thank you for inviting me on. So Vista as an organisation, we're perhaps quite a well-kept secret, really, but we look after some of the UK's largest employers working with HR teams to provide them advice on all things employment law. So we're solicitors or barristers by background. We've all had significant sort of careers either in private practice. Some of my colleagues have worked for trade unions. I've been in-house for a FTSE 250 company. And we try very much to get away from the traditional employment law firm model to become more of a sort of an in-house support for our HR teams, and that whether that be through advice on how to handle employment law, employee relations type issues, or we'll conduct investigations when actually it's the right thing to do to get it out of the organization in terms of having somebody externally investigating something, or the part of the business I look after, which is to provide training and development for HR and line managers on all things people management, really, but with a real sort of focus on supporting them to do the ER side of their job really well, which is something we know that they sometimes feel lacking in confidence in doing.
Yeah, because it's really scary, let's face it. Yeah. You know, it's quite easy to get the wrong side of the law. And the last thing anyone wants to do as an HR professional, you're being held up as a person to protect the organisation in many cases, quite often without any expert guidance or support. There's lots of standalone people out there who are really, they've got the world on their shoulders in terms of these things.
Yes.
You don't want to get it
wrong.
It's a big responsibility.
No.
So I can see
absolutely.
So that's some of the training that you do would give people confidence, but also you can support your organisation also supports people in an in-house facility. There's two aspects, training people and in-house support.
And giving them advice. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And dealing with and managing tribunals, that sort of thing. The what would be the usual lawyering we do, but we like to feel that we do it in a way that's much more aligned to the organisation than you can do when you're external to them in that sense. And we tend to work on a kind of long term relationship type basis in order to kind of get to know the organisation really well.
Now, I understand that makes sense. Brilliant. OK, so the point of this, as we said earlier, there are many topics that we could go down and maybe we will come back to other topics. But the one that we felt was really, really relevant right now, because there's lots of uncharted territory for people, is what are the potential employment law or challenges to be aware of around setting up a hybrid work or managing a hybrid workforce?
Yes.
I know you've got a great model. I'll hand to you more like a masterclass stage and perhaps ask questions along the way, because this is your expertise. I don't have any knowledge on this.
Yes, of course. Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, the model that I tend to use is in terms of thinking about this is something I actually use when I'm giving legal advice. And I also sort of train HR professionals to use it in their own way, and also managers when they're thinking about how to manage. And it's very straightforward, really. It's a three-part Venn diagram that says, look, let's look at employment law as a whole. And it's the three parts are the employment contract. What does our statutory employment law sort of obligations say to us? And what do our policies and procedures say? And as I say, it's a great way of making sure that we've considered all aspects of a particular topic. So in this case, hybrid working. And what I'd like to do today is think about what's involved in terms of the employment law aspects, both in terms of setting up a hybrid working model, driving productivity and maintaining sort of a positive culture, but also sort of can we use it to anticipate where challenges might arise and sort of planning for changing business needs. And the reason why I suggest this is I think employers generally, and that's been by HR teams, have done an absolutely brilliant job of getting people out of the working environment wherever we could, yeah, following that government guidance of work from home wherever you can. And in the main, employees have just gone with it. And that's not inevitable. That's because of the way in which HR have dealt with it. But when this becomes much more now of the norm,
yeah,
what do we need to think about in order to make sure that actually everything still works well, rather than working in our emergency times and calling on everybody's sort of goodwill in that respect? Are there things that we need to specifically think about as this becomes much more the, dare I say it, new normal?
Yes, because that's the term that I can imagine that there would be employers that are fearful that is it custom and practice that okay, so it's acceptable in an emergency situation, which we'd all accept we were during lockdown, expect people to work in a different way of working. I think most contracts have got something that says we expect you to work in the office or anywhere else that we deem fit line in our contracts, don't we?
Yeah. But
the whole thing is then once people are used to working remotely, and I saw some evidence a couple of weeks ago saying that actually the majority of people have preferred it to some extent. That's not saying they want to be 100% remotely, and employers feel they want to get people into the office. It's all a really tricky environment, and you've got people who are shielding. It's so complex, and it seems quite, my perception in the past of law is that you've got to treat everybody the same, and actually it feels like, to be fair in this environment, you've got to treat people fairly in relation to their individual circumstances. And I don't know how, yeah, that sits with the law.
Yeah, absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So if we start with that employment contract question, first of all, you're absolutely right. All employment contracts will have a place of work clause in them in some way. But we have bent that out of shape by what we've agreed to do at the moment in a lot of instances. And is that mismatch okay? Now, it might be in the short term because everybody's understood the context of moving away from the office. But if there comes a time where we want to be able to return a person back into a business because of their individual circumstances, perhaps their performance or perhaps their behavior, or we want to move their role back in, where does that mismatch take us? Because you're absolutely right that there is this idea of custom and practice that sort of develops over time. But actually, from a legal framework perspective, you can change a contract verbally. You don't have to change that in writing. So what's the effect of that conversation? Because, of course, you've then got an evidential issue in terms of, did we agree that you were going to be permanently working from home? Or is this that it was just that temporary measure and we can still rely on that term in the contract? There'll be a point in time where we need to kind of get the reality and the contract to conform in some way. Now, that in and of itself creates some questions that kind of bring in the other parts of this Venn diagram in terms of, there's one thing changing something by consent, i.e. both parties have agreed to it. But if we're looking to enforce that change, that requires a great degree of consultation, all of those sorts of things. So I think there's something about being intentional about that, not letting it drift, that sort of causes us to start to think, as time passes, should we be doing something about this? And that for me then brings in a bit of an OD question. Have we agreed that individual is working from home because of their personal circumstances, or is it about their particular role and we're comfortable that becomes a permanent change? And shielding is a good example of that. Are we saying it's just the person, the incumbent in that role, if you like, at the minute? Or actually, are we comfortable that that role is, for example, working from home?
And can we say that? So can you, I get the fact a role, that's kind of quite straightforward because it's a bit like a redundancy thing, right? That's treating everyone fairly if it's the role. But if you're saying everyone else with role X has to work in the office, but we're okay for person Jane to work at home because she's shielding, is that, but other people who've been forced to come into the office who aren't shielding, where does that leave us? It feels like that's unfair, and that the people who've had to come to the office could actually raise a claim if they wanted to.
Yeah, I see your point. And I think it depends upon the reason for allowing that individual, because of course it could even be a reasonable adjustment that we need to consider. So if that the reason for the shielding is because of a medical condition that amounts to a disability, we're under a duty to make a reasonable adjustment. And is that an adjustment that we need to consider making for that individual? Not that we're obliged to, of course. There's the other side to this, which is to say the employee might say, well, I need you to make an adjustment. But if actually that makes it very difficult, how do we square that with that individual to make sure that we demonstrate that we've complied with our duties, but that just so happens not to be a reasonable adjustment based on the nature of that person's role?
And this is where it becomes really grey, and I see questions that people ask. So, Jane doesn't personally have a health issue, which therefore could be a disability, but she lives with somebody who is at risk, so she's shielding. And then you've got the other people who are coming into the office. It's just this discretionary piece here. Is it? I probably think I've got to give everybody the fair option to work remotely in that circumstance, which then goes back to you've got to make that role home-based, which may then mean that you can't enforce that role comes in. I guess probably isn't an easy answer, but is there any other clarity you could do to make a decision as to how to be fair on everybody, but actually if you want people to be in the office to maximize the chances of those people being
yes in? Yes, I think you're absolutely right. There's one thing about permanent base, of course, but there's other things around what I describe as a manager's right to manage. So actually you can set some expectations that actually, if we do really need to do something face-to-face in a COVID secure working environment, that a manager has got the right to be able to say, actually, we need everybody in. And these are the circumstances where that might arise, and this is what we'll do to make sure that COVID security happens. And this is really the essence of this, isn't it? It's a yeah. good quality conversation. Managers being confident in what they have the right to do, but then actually explaining why it is that needs to be done face to face, and accommodating things like, well, I don't want to travel on public transport in rush hour, so let's set that meeting in the middle of the day. You know, something like that actually they feel equipped to, the managers feel equipped to have those conversations in a constructive way.
So that is when you are sort of almost, it's almost an insurance, isn't it? So the fact that rather than letting things slip again, it's thinking about a proactive communication, and whether that's a manager, I don't know whether this fits into contract or a policy, you know, a policy, and I know you've not gone onto the policies yet, but is it about having something that says, actually, we are going to allow, our preference is that people come into the office. We are wanting to treat everybody fairly, which means if someone's got certain circumstances, we may take those into account. However, we still stand by the fact we have got the right to request people come in, and we would do everything in our power to make sure that the time was acceptable and it was a safe thing. But this, we still have the right. So it's almost you have to proactively communicate that if you've got this slightly unequal setup. Would it be better to yes. do that rather than repent later?
Yes, I think so. Set the expectations proactively first, and then give managers the skills to be able to have those good quality conversations, really.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right, Lucinda, that there is an overlap between the contract piece and the policies and procedures piece here. And that's why it's a Venn diagram, really. There is a blurring between the two. But I think under the kind of contract heading, I talk quite a lot with managers about their right to manage, their right to sort of set reasonable instructions, really, if you like. And that would be something that you would start to build in a hybrid working environment to say, look, the norm may well be working from home, but that doesn't mean to say that your manager may not require you to come into the office from time to time type thing. It's almost the the reverse of what we see in the your normal place of works is X office, but we can require you to work elsewhere. You're almost seeing that sort of flipping itself around, aren't you?
Well, that's a really interesting. Yes, that is exactly what it is, isn't it? And so could you see people moving that? Is it worth making a change like that or a different clause? What do you recommend people?
Well, I think that is going to be the case, isn't it? We can't rely on what will be an out of date contractual term. Eventually, it's going to potentially cause us some challenges. And I think we've got to be quite intentional about it. As I say, we've got to make the choice to say, this is the way that in which we're working going forward. And we need to kind of have our commitment that we make with our employee, which at the end of the day is their contract, to reflect the reality. And that isn't necessarily even now, but going into 2021, it's something that I think we'll need to, as HR communities, think about in that sense. Yeah.
And that's relevant, isn't it? Because we've had our extreme abnormal piece, and now we're going into what may be an extended normal with and things. And then it's almost in about 6 months' time, when you'd like to think that the risks of people being on public transport, for example, are lower if they did want to go in. But by then, people have been working remotely potentially for a year, and that feels like they're right as opposed to their contract. That's where we've got to always be quite proactive about what it says in there. And actually, on that, that's the other thing contractually. So quite often, I mean, I remember when I had home working in my contract, that meant that I could claim back travel to the office when I was there. And I know that that's something that can... I mean, a benefit to a number of people who were, say, commuting into London is the lack of cost. All of a sudden, if they're expected to go back into, they've been used to having that money in their pockets, being expected to go back into London, they're probably going to, and the, you know, car parking charges, the cost actually from where we live, commuting is a significant amount.
Yes.
That's going to be a weird one there. And if you change the contract, we're saying you work anywhere, but, and that whole, can we claim back on heating and all those sort of things?
Absolutely right. I completely agree with you. And we'll start to see people asking these longer term questions, employees raising it in terms of, as you say, if you think about people that have season tickets for commuting in, because that's what they're do they renew those? There is going to start to be questions being raised by that. Absolutely. And there will be a knock on effect of the normal place of work being at home. We need to work some of those through in terms of even what benefit packages we offer. You know, all of those things will become relevant to make sure that the whole remuneration package is what it needs to be for an organization. And that's what I mean about kind of being quite intentional about this. Let's be clear as to what the effect of that would be.
So you think the answer now? Sorry.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think so. Not necessarily make a decision now, but start to think about what the implications of that could be. And I think building on that as well, in terms of have people's jobs changed as a result of home working? A lot of us have just adapted what we're doing. Our roles and responsibilities fundamentally haven't changed. But, you know, if you are a manager of a big team, has that job changed? And the way I kind of tend to judge that is say, look, is it a change in job? So in other words, it's just a change in a way of working, or is it a change of job? So it's a fundamental change. And in which case, how do we recognize that? We don't just want to necessarily let that sort of go along and then suddenly turn around and say, actually, I'm doing something completely different to what I originally thought I was doing, because that could be relevant to the way that person feels in terms of motivation. But also, you know, when you come to, if you have to look at your workforce from a redundancy perspective, if it's fundamentally changed, what does that do in terms of things like pools for selection and that sort of thing? Just one of those things to have our radar up about, I think.
Yeah, that's an interesting one for me, because I also think, and this is maybe slightly sad, is that people who were line managers and were, and I say line managers, and I'll use my inverted commas fingers going here, as in they had people who were direct reports, but they really weren't managing them. And they got away with that possibly in a face-to-face environment, because you could see people, right? They could ask you a question, but you weren't necessarily managing them. If now, currently, if they're remote, if you, the time it takes, I think, to manage people well remotely is actually probably higher to keep connected, to keep productivity, than it perhaps was. Now, I think you could argue that that's really what you should have been doing all along. So I don't know, it's a change in job. It's perhaps That's probably a bit of a red herring, but it's an interesting.
No, I know what you mean. And I think there is a fundamental difference between actually fundamentally what my job is doing has changed now as a result of the fact that we're all dispersed, as opposed to I should have been effectively people managing on the basis of output rather than presenteeism, which is perhaps what a lot of team managers have done. Mm. And I think this does start us to think about other parts of the Venn diagram, including things like our appraisal processes, how even we measure what performance is. You know, you can tell how somebody is when they walk in and sit down in the desk or the pod or the desk next to you, in just how their shoulders are set, whether they slam their belongings on the desk or not. And it kind of prompts a conversation.
Yeah.
But actually, when you're starting a working day and you know you've got a series of calls in with that individual, the temptation is to go straight into, right, let's talk about, rather than what's going on for you at the moment. Mm-hmm. And giving managers confidence to have those sorts of conversations so that they are managing in more and more in the day to day around this new environment, I think is important, as well as setting shorter term objectives rather than objectives that last, you know, 3-6 months.
Yeah.
Let's manage by output now, which I think will make people feel much more connected. Yeah. This is very much more your area, Lucinda, than mine, I think. But there
I'm
is
just glad you're saying the same thing that I've been saying. Thank good. That's what I think as well.
But that's the thing, people, we need to see that we're connected to a bigger thing than just our kind of silo, yeah, aren't we? And if we're just delivering kind of what we think is the right thing without seeing how it connects to the bigger machinery, people are going to get demotivated very quickly, I think.
Yes, and I know there's a whole thing about well-being, which is all, you know, at the end of the day, you've got well-being and all those sort of aspects around it. Is for me, this whole scenario means that we have to remember that we're human beings. And I know it sounds strange, but we could almost pretend that we weren't. When you saw people in the office, you could put a smile and go, hi, how was your weekend? Have a bit of a chit chat and just get on with it. And you knew people were there working on stuff. But now, because people do that bit at arm's length, it is quite different. And I think you've got to stretch your, you're just going to make an effort individually with human relationships to get the best out of people in these circumstances. And that is, yeah, people management, it's hard work. HR is hard work. People management is hard work in these environments as well. But that's, I guess, another topic. So I suppose before we went on to your next bit of the Venn diagram, just staying on the contract piece. So with something like home working, is there an in-between? So if people said, well, you are now basically saying me, I'm a home worker, so you've got to pay for my travel. Or is there, is there an in-between place that contractually that we could be, as in you can work from home, but still officially you're office based, but we let you work from home, but that still means that the transport onus is on you. We're just not going to make you come in 5 days a week.
Yes. I mean, yes, absolutely. You can frame that relationship however you think works for the organization. It's just a question of thinking through those implications. People, I think, will look for what we're saying your normal base is. And yes, we're quite used to that language of your normal place of work is, because we're obliged to make sure as a minimum we provide that, the sense of that. And I guess it's just then a question of how we say, but day to day, this is what our expectations are, and getting clarity in a less than certain set of circumstances is going to be crucial. That you would probably start to put into a policy that then is brought alive by manager capability in terms of having that conversation. And that's where I think the issue can start to break down. We can be as clear as we like in a policy. It needs to be brought alive by the manager, and making sure that that's handled well, I think, is a key question here, to avoid conflict, grievances, you know, that sort of thing arising.
So there's a whole separate bit of management development almost. So if HR can look at putting in policies that protect the organization but are hopefully win-win enough in terms that they reflect the current working contract, so you've got to think about,
yes,
what that is and what the consequences are, and basically what is the answer to the question of okay, we're not going to pay for your travel, but then does that mean if we expect you to work from home that we have to provide you with a desk and a monitor and these other things?
Yes. And having a conversation about a conducive working environment as well, in terms of, again, you know, in the immediate term, I think everybody accepted that there was cats wandering across the screens, and, you know, we were having to homeschool at that point. So actually there's going to be a degree of interruption. when this is going beyond that emergency set of circumstances, are we okay with that? And if we aren't okay with it as an organisation, how do managers have the conversation about a conducive working environment that is constructive rather than the eye rolling, oh God, you've got, you know, Teletubbies on in the background again, type thing, where, as we know, then managers only then deal with situations when it's become crisis. Let's be clear about, you know, what our expectations are and what are the barriers to doing that, and how do we kind of, as an organisation, take some responsibility for that.
So it is, clarity again is always the point, isn't it, about avoiding performance issues of whatever type. And it's almost like we need a whole new set of what's the good Zoom etiquette? You know, what is good, you know, and those sort of things. That just, this is what good. And I think it's interesting because if you're not clear about it, actually, people do interpret things in different ways, don't they?
Yes.
And I can think you can give two extreme examples. For example, we were doing some interviewing recently, and actually, you know, there's a lot of people out on the marketplace. So you would, for a 30-minute Zoom interview, you'd expect that people could be able to create an environment or choose a time. They could choose a time. And this one person actually decided to have their child sitting on the knee while they were being interviewed for a job. And you think that's, yeah, and this is not during lockdown, this is last week. And I think that's an interesting expectation of what would be required. Don't get me wrong, I'm completely understand if there's exceptional circumstances, but there's something there, because people, and then if someone else sees that, do they think that that is a normal or an acceptable way of acting? So maybe it is about us creating clarity, but maybe involving the organization in that, in terms of line managers chart, you know, what does good management, what does good productivity look like without being presenteeism? Maybe those are the sort of things that we start to try and proactively define our culture in a remote working way.
I agree. And that sense of kind of creating a fairness around the conversation that managers are having about people's performance. Because of course the risk is that we judge people's performance based on presenteeism on a Zoom call type thing. Oh, that person's always speaking up. Whereas people who are slightly perhaps more introverted in their nature, perhaps don't participate as much. They get sort of forgotten about to a point, and therefore are not valued by their manager when it comes to whatever we end up doing around appraisal or PDR. Mm. And this takes us back, I think, about lots of shorter term objectives that actually give us a consistent platform on which to measure people's performance.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're agreed with the person and they agree the time frame and they're owning and driving that. I mean, again, the irony is really is it is best practice. It's what it's always been, best practice. But this maybe could be a driver to actually get those sort of activities doing, which could mean that people are more productive and more satisfied than perhaps they might have been previously, if we can get there with it.
But I suppose, No, I was just going to say one of the particular challenges here is if we're looking at a hybrid workforce, so we've got perhaps some in the office, some at home.
Yes.
You've still got the traditional method of kind of evaluating people, because you've got the ones that are coming in or perhaps are aligned to when the manager's tending to go into the office, where you've got the people for very legitimate reasons who perhaps are going in less or whatever it might be. Then you've not even got a level playing field to be able to judge people unless you do something like output-driven, short-term, objective-based management of performance. Yeah.
So, I mean, arguably, though, that would have been your policy anyway. I'm not sure that an appraisal policy, a performance management policy, would necessarily look any different in this environment. But maybe what we're saying is it really wasn't being applied. I don't know. Would you say there's a change in the policies there?
Well, I think there was an interesting move, wasn't there, starting sort of 2, 3, 4 years ago, around let's move away from annual appraisal to more performance conversations. And I think those are organisations that have adopted that, as long as managers are having those conversations, are probably further along the curve in terms of dealing with this. One of my colleagues says, well, a lot of what we're talking about here is ordinary sort of management decisions in extraordinary times. And I think that's right. Mm. I think that's right. But what I do think it is doing is shining a light on where there might be some gaps, where managers are naturally managing perhaps based on, you know, personality, because we know there's always a tendency to do that because we engage more with people that are like us type thing. So, I agree with you, Lucinda, to a point that there's probably a lot of just kind of making sure we really do some good things with the things that we were already planning in this space.
Yeah, it's doing what we should have been doing well. I mean, and you could be having year-round conversations. You could have been having regular check-ins. That doesn't mean you were setting objectives. Often it was a chat, so it is that sort of just chunking
Yes.
down, as you were saying earlier. So then,
Yes.
I mean, how do people manage? You've got this strange right environment. How do people manage perceived underperformance? And I mean, are you seeing anything from a I mean, it's probably too early for tribunals because everything's taking years, isn't it? Taking longer to go anywhere anyway. But what are
Yes.
the risks, I suppose, about managing performance from an employment law point of view at the moment?
Well, I think again that there's a lot of sort of similarities to the previous problems. Not nipping situations in the bud, I think, is one thing. And so allowing that underperformance to continue beyond really where it should, so that either the employee is surprised about that feedback or thinks, well, actually, is it that serious? You should have mentioned it to me before. I think, you know, that is more and more of the case. Being unspecific in around what the performance issue is. Oh, they're always, you know, 5 minutes late on the Zoom meeting and you know, those sorts of things. Or they're not a team player. They're never proactive, as opposed to actually being a lot more specific about what the performance gap actually is. I think we're seeing. And of course, manager saying, oh, well, the reason why perhaps we're not picking up on that is we see less of them. So I'll have that conversation when I see them next. Well, you might not see them for some time. So you can't just put your performance management on hold and that sort of thing. And then if you're looking at the more kind of formal end of processes, there's the nervousness around managers dealing with a remote formal hearing, whether that's a disciplinary or a performance management conversation. Do they feel equipped to manage that formal hearing when it is done over Teams or Zoom? Not fundamentally different again, but it's just recognizing you're not seeing as much body language, for example. You're needing to make sure you're having good quality conversations about the issue so that the employee doesn't feel locked out of that important conversation that there has to be if you're going to have a good quality, you know, formal meeting.
So, I mean, it is the same, what you're saying really is the same processes. Ideally, you'd use video and you'd preempt it in the first place by having a direct conversation. Not leaving things to fester on, and
yes,
and people are then shocked. You know, they think they're doing the best they can, but actually they're working on the wrong things, because quite often it often obviously comes back to lack of clarity in the individual without having the objectives or feedback.
Yes,
so same as usual, but there's no other sort of, again, so the risk I'd always be concerned again is this whole idea of you not being consistent, but then because we're in an environment where we are almost forced to being inconsistent, but I suppose in that context it's about performance, so that is being consistent, right?
Consistency is a really interesting one for me, because we are always trying to grapple with that, I think, and it's the level of consistency at which you're looking at the issue. So if, let's say, you and I are both underperforming, we are peers, we do the same job, the cause of your underperformance and my underperformance are going to be very different. And therefore, the solution to deal with that underperformance is going to be very different. So actually, the process that you follow to help us both improve is going to be very different. And that doesn't make it inconsistent. It makes it tailored for the individual. So giving managers the kind of skills to have the insight into what's actually going on, rather than just assuming that both Vicky and Lucinda are not applying themselves and that's why they're underperforming, sort of thing, is crucial here, so you can get a properly tailored response. So even if they don't look the same, the reason why they don't look the same is not unfair on either of us, because it's tailored to our individual sets of circumstances.
Okay, that's really, yes, that makes sense. Because so would it be possible to almost walk through a kind of an example? Because I'm imagining then that you're treating us both, we've both got different causes of underperformance, and that might mean that one of us would keep our job, for argument's sake, because you could turn the underperformance around, and one of us might lose our job, and you are still and I might come, but let's say I've almost lost my job and I'm taking you to tribunal because it's not fair because you kept Vicky on and she was also underperforming.
Yeah.
What might be a scenario if you're each of those where you could see that, you know, following that process, that might be an example of something that would be different as a cause of underperformance, I suppose, in these circumstances, that would work through? Because I think bringing it to life.
Yeah, I think I can give you an example of a situation where we supported an organization, and they were food sales organizations. So they had team members who were responsible for going to see venues, so that's schools or hospitals or pubs and restaurants in their particular area, and selling their wares, and they were consistently underperforming compared to budget. And so they kept setting new objectives, which were, right, you need to sell a certain percentage in a certain time scale of your overall annual budget. And when they didn't hit it, they just kept kind of changing those goalposts, making it less and less of a kind of stretch target, if you like, and they still weren't performing. And it wasn't until we started to encourage conversations around, well, why weren't they performing, why weren't they selling the required amounts, that it actually unlocked what the cause of the performance gap is, if you like. So let's say, it's you and I, Lucinda. The reason I was underperforming was that I was being very inefficient in the way I was planning my route to see the potential customers on my patch. Mm-hmm. So instead of me being able to squeeze 4 clients in a day, I was only seeing 1. Whereas for you, you felt yourself to be an expert in the fresh food piece offering, but didn't really understand what was going on in the frozen. So you weren't kind of, when you were seeing your customers, you weren't
selling the frozen
talking
stuff
broadly. Yeah, exactly, talking broadly enough. And so actually the plan that our manager would put in for both of us had to be very different. And the speed at which you turned your sales around was probably at a different pace than it was for me. But the speed of those of that action plan, if you like, needed to be very different to respond to those set of circumstances. If I managed to get there in what could be considered to be a reasonable time scale, I kept my job, I continued to perform. But perhaps you didn't kind of respond to your action plan, and therefore, having followed the formal process, you lost your job at the end of it. That would still be fair because it was tailored to your set of circumstances.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I can see that basically if I was given the training to understand the frozen food and I still didn't sell it, then that maybe is a kind of capability thing. And I suppose on your example, it could have been that, you've been told to take a shorter route, but actually you're still there only doing, you've been told it's a time management, so it's organization thing. So then it becomes a will if it's possible for other people to do 4, then you might. So either case, you're saying it's depending on how people respond to the intervention means whether or not they would potentially be retained legitimately.
Absolutely. And a tailored action plan is crucial. And it doesn't mean to say that it's unfair by any means. No.
But I guess, again, this comes back to documentation. So you say, so this is what we've identified the reason is, and we've documented it, and this is the plan that we've put in place to support the individual, and we have that captured.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Great. Okay. So I guess keeping moving, it's very interesting. We're keeping still going, aren't we? So anything else on policies and procedures before we move on to statutory stuff?
I think picking up really on what we were talking about earlier in terms of, do our policies work for a hybrid working environment? Are they still appropriate? And that, I think, is something that will require a review, everything from our instructions around managing our IT infrastructure. All of those things will be relevant to kind of, if some people are working from home, some people are working remotely, just making sure that there aren't some gaps around instructions around that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, things like confidentiality, I think, is a key point. Mm-hmm. Do we make sure that people know that they shouldn't be leaving client confidential information around in a home office that's unsecure, making sure that they know how to dispose of things and that they should be even thinking about that. We've almost not had to think about that quite so much in some environments that we should be doing now, I think.
Yes, for people to be productive, you had to open up IT and access things like that, which you need to make sure people know how to use it responsibly, don't we?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, great. So there's some really useful aspects there about the contractor policies and procedures and certainly thinking it's worth us thinking proactively about what changes we need to make. Lots of it is still the same, but it goes back down to communication and doing decent management, choosing people consistently and documenting things. A lot of that hasn't really changed. There are things about maybe the contractors, whether we think about that, and do we need new policies around confidentiality and also being really certain that people have have read and taken those on board. It's perhaps something to refresh there. Then I suppose moving to your third bit of your Venn diagram, which was about the statutory employment law aspects, what aspects there apply?
So we've touched on a lot on some of these already, I think, but thinking about the discrimination risk in terms of inclusivity, is that something that we ought to be aware of? Some of this is around neurodiversity, working through this sort of environment, and that touches on this sort of extroversion, introversion type idea, I think, as well. But also discrimination risks on the basis of age or perhaps disability are crucial. And thinking also about childcare responsibilities and therefore indirect discrimination. One of the things I think that might become relevant in a hybrid environment in particular is, are we being much more sort of strict around our working hours where people are going into the office, whereas actually people who are working from home, because it's not as visible, it kind of doesn't matter when you're doing your work, and is that okay? And that may give rise to people saying, look, because I have to work in the office because of the nature of my role, and I might accept that, but you're expecting the 9 to 5 from me, where I know my counterparts can do work whenever they jolly well like, and that gives rise to some discrimination challenges in one way or another.
And in terms of the disability one, that's also coming down to things like health. The health issues could come into that and be viewed as a disability potentially.
Yes, absolutely. So it picks up on the shielding point that you were making earlier around, there is a duty to make a reasonable adjustment in that sense, to think about the working environment for the individual rather than for the role in that sense. Yeah.
Okay, so it's all this, again, things, there's not necessarily any magic, there's no magic wand, is there? I'm not hearing a magic wand yet.
No, afraid not.
It's still quite lots of grey stuff, as you've just got to consider all of these things in terms of do things and carry on being consistent. As you've noticed, there's a point you've made here about flexible working. I mean, that's an interesting one. Is that what you'll make the point in terms of if people are office-based, it could seem that we're being unfair, whereas we might grant flexible working for someone who's remote, but not if they're office?
Yeah, so there's flexible working around the place of work. So if we've decided if we've made a decision about hybrid working, and we've made that decision on an OD basis, i.e. a role basis rather than an individual, be aware of what a flexible working request might be around, well, actually, I don't really care what the role says, I would still like to work from home. We'll still have to make sure that we deal with that, however much thinking we might have done around it. And there is often a real fear of sort of setting an unwanted precedent in that sense. But going back to your point about consistency, you can make decisions based on the current state. So, if we're all peers working in a team of 15 and an organization can cope with 5 of us working from home, but we can't cope with all 15 working from home, if you or I just so happen to be the 6th request, then it can be turned down, relying on the statutory reasons for refusing that request. And other area,
I'm just thinking about our team and our support team. So that's one of those that if you think about it proactively, though, ideally you think about it as a team, don't you? And so we want to allow flexible working, but you are a team. We've also got to cover for the customers. So before you accept one, it's almost about if we can work it out between the team to have some flexibility. I think that's what I would want to see, some solutions coming from the people in place. Otherwise, that seems really unfair for the last person to put in there, yes, doesn't it? So you've got to think about the knock-on before you do grant the first one, I suppose, haven't you?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely right. But again, bearing in mind that their rights are still there for people to make that request, and we've got to consider those with an open mind. Whatever good work we might have been doing proactively, we can't think, oh, look, we've already thought about this. We're going to have to still, consider those with an open mind, certainly, and follow our processes to be able to kind of respond to those requests and give reasons that are within the sort of eight statutory reasons to respond to them. The other thing I think here is around trial periods. That for me is the single biggest challenge, I think, generally around flexible working requests. What we tend to see is people push perhaps the difficult decisions into the long grass by saying, well, let's trial it. And, that trials are important. In fact, the ACAS code recommends that you do consider them. But let's not sort of set up an expectation that trials are going to kind of end up with everybody in the same place, because if we don't give regular feedback through the trial period, the employee is going to assume it's all worked perfectly, whereas a manager may well be thinking, God, this has been a nightmare, but I haven't sort of given that feedback. Yeah. We are going to do a trial period. Let's set some regular check-ins to give an honest feedback about how it's going.
Yes, and actually keep control of it. And again, don't let it run away from you.
Yes, yes, right. Absolutely.
Okay, great. So, Vicky, as we thought there was going to be, there's so much stuff we can cover, isn't there? We've gone on a little bit longer than we planned, but I think it's all good stuff. Are there any final points you want to make before we start wrapping up?
No, I think for me, it is about sort of stepping back and recognising that we'll need to consider some challenges coming about the current status quo. Let's not assume that just because we've managed to do a good job of it now, not to take away from that, because I think that there's been some heroics gone on within HR teams over the last few months to get everybody where they need to be.
Yeah.
Let's then start to think about what the next step should be in terms of what's the longer term going to mean and what conversation should we be having, and apply the usual employment law principles to that. But I think we can start planning that now to iron out what could be some issues in the future.
Because
really,
some of them are predictable, aren't they? We can see these coming.
Yes. Yes, we can.
As opposed to having to do stuff overnight, which is what HR people were doing in March this year.
This is it. Yeah. This is it. Or having to react to either business change or employee demand, which is not something that actually often makes the best good quality decisions, does it?
No, exactly. So thank you hugely for coming on and being so generous with your time, Vicky. There's a set of slides here. I don't know if they're on your website or perhaps I'll put some link in the show notes. I'll check with you after as to whether people can come to you for further information.
Of course.
Show notes, I'll get you to do that. Maybe these slides might be just useful if people wanted to see that little structure.
Yes, of course.
Am I right in thinking you've got a training course happening in November that's when we reach out? What's that to do?
Yes,
with?
Yeah, we've got some series of mock employment tribunals that's being it. Run, but they are digital ones. So one of the big changes that we've had to get used to is that the tribunal service is running their hearings remotely. So it occurred to me that actually, as the HR community get used to kind of managing them within their organization, it might be worth having a little bit of insight about what the difference is when it's a remote hearing, what the experience feels like, and so that they can kind of best equip their managers who might be witnesses. So what we've done with it is do a mock employment tribunal on a redundancy situation where the employee says they've been unfairly selected for redundancy because they've been furloughed and have been unable to demonstrate.
Can their be goosebumps, but it sounds very relevant.
Yeah. So unfortunately, at time of recording, our November date is fully booked, but we are running some more dates in December and January. And given the feedback, there'll be more coming in the new year, because I don't see we'll be going back to running physical mock employment tribunals, which we have tended to do probably until the second half of next year. So absolutely, there'll be more.
We'll get the links in the show notes. So if people want to access that, it sounds very interesting, then
yes,
to find you. So just for the sake of the audio, what's the best email or LinkedIn, what's the best route if people want to connect with you?
Yes, LinkedIn, I use my Sunday best name, which is Victoria Roberts, so best way to find me that way. But my email address is vroberts@vista-online.co.uk. Feel Brilliant. Free to drop me a line if there's any other questions that anybody has who's watched this.
That's fantastic. So I will put all these in the show notes for those of you listening. And I just want to say thanks again, Vicky. That was really educational and fascinating. So much Good. Appreciate your time. Thanks again.
No problem at all. Pleasure.
Hi, everybody. Just a quick word at the end of this podcast that I hope you found enjoyable with Vicky. I thought it was very interesting and so much to get into. But sometimes we reflected, you just want maybe direct answers, some black and white content. So Vicky, which was great to work with, and she offered to come on again on the HR Uprising, maybe more than once, if there were specific topics that our audience, i.e. you, would like her to cover from an employment law viewpoint. So I just thought I'd throw that out there, give you a chance to reflect, and if there is something that you'd really like us to do as a podcast from an employment law point of view, can you get in touch with us? Obviously, join our HR Uprising group and you can tag it there. You can email me directly. However you like, there's lots of ways in which you can get to me through LinkedIn. And just let us know what would be helpful or valuable to you from an employment law viewpoint. And I know that Vicky said she'd be willing to support and do follow-up episodes if that were the case. Okay, so look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you for listening to the HR Uprising, proudly brought to you by Actor Software, the joined-up performance and talent management solution. You can access links to any of the information or resources mentioned in the show via the podcast page at www.hruprising.com. If you like what we do, please subscribe, tell your colleagues, and leave a review. Thank you for listening to the HR Uprising.